We're visiting with former State Representative Jack Gunderson. Jack was first elected in the election of 1964 to the House of Representatives, and the last session in which he served was the 1977 session. He, however, was involved in politics before he ran for the legislature, and then I believe you served in state government here in Helena in an administrative job afterwards?
Yeah, afterwards I managed the state Hale department for 4.5 years.
Okay. And so you're still living here in Helena?
Yeah, at that time I bought the duplex in Helena.
And so you're still here?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, Jack Gunderson was a friend of mine, of course, when I served in the legislature, and I'm pleased to have an opportunity to interview him. Jack, what got you involved in politics?
My dad was elected to the legislature in about 1941, I think it was, and he served 5 terms in the House. And
that was from where?
I think it must have been about 1941.
But where did what was the district?
Oh, from Cascade County. See, at that time we all
ran at large
ran
in the
at
county.
Large, and I think we had 9 representatives from Cascade County at that time.
Okay, and so then you served from Cascade County also.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
In that same system, at least to begin with.
Sure.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then you would have served with John Willits?
Oh yeah, I think he was elected the same year as I was in 1965, but another interesting thing, my brother ran for the legislature in 1959, and I can't remember who was governor then, but...
Aronson would have been.
Probably Aronson, yeah. But what then, Nutter came in when, in 1970?
No, Nutter came in 1960.
Yeah, that's probably right.
Yeah.
Anyway, my brother served in 1959, and we had Democrats had control of Cascade County. But I don't know, there was 9 or 11 represented, I don't remember for sure. But anyway, you know, it was pretty predominantly Democratic, and then the Republicans came in, and they had control of the delegation.
In the 1960 election?
Yeah.
And the issue was the public utility district issue, wasn't it? The PUD issue?
Yeah, that was one of them. And then there was a pretty good scandal about the highway department at that time. And this engineer wanted to build an interstate highway down on the east side, I believe, of Holter Lake.
And okay.
I think he got fired over it, but the powers to be wanted to go where it goes up now.
And so that was an issue in the campaign that hurt the Democrats?
Well, that was in 1959, but then the Republicans had control there. Yeah. And then,
well, how did the Republicans, what was the issue that brought the Republicans to, that gave them a big victory in 1960?
Well, I think, you know, it was probably partially this highway department fiasco, and I really can't remember why, but anyway, they just had control of it, I think. 11.
But Jack, wasn't this PUD deal an issue too then? I've heard this in other interviews.
Oh yeah, that was, but...
Do you remember what do you remember about that? I know that was before you became personally involved, but you must have visited with your brother about it.
Well, I don't know, you know, then they had that Knowles Dam up on the Flathead, south of Flathead Lake there. That was a big issue too. During the legislature, and
that wouldn't have been an issue in Cascade County, though, would it?
No, it wasn't. Yeah, yeah. But you know, the way the party politics run. But then the year that I ran, we just reversed it. We went from 11 or 10-1 to Republican. We went 10-1 Democrat.
Yeah, because 64 was a big year for Democrats.
Yeah, yeah. Pat Gilweather and John Willits and Pete Gilligan. Well, Jack McDonald at that time was a...
Yes, he was a Democrat.
Democrat.
Yeah, yeah. And John Stagmiller?
Yeah. Well, John didn't get elected until a couple of years later.
Did he? I see. Okay.
Yeah.
I knew him, of course, too.
But, you know, that's where Jack McDonald started the whole issue of, revising the Constitution.
That's
the
right.
Constitutional Convention.
And so he was a young state representative with you then, a Democrat from Cascade County.
Yeah.
And he was later elected to the state senate as a Democrat from Cascade County, and then changed parties and ran for Congress, I think.
Yeah. Well, he's been Republican ever since. He's ran for Congress, Senator, everything else.
But his significant contribution to Montana was that he felt the Constitution was outdated and that we needed a new one, so he introduced a bill which ultimately resulted in the calling of the Constitutional Convention that resulted in our 1972 Constitution.
Yeah, that's the one big thing Jack did, but that's, You know, at that time I was a freshman legislator in 65, and
yeah,
and just different issues I was interested in at the time. Every time you turn around, you're running into this outdated constitution.
Yeah.
So, you know, I was a big supporter of calling for a new constitution and worked on it. And I was one of the few legislators when they had the Con that came up, and I spent a lot of time at the Constitutional Convention.
What were your impressions of the Constitutional Convention?
Well, I thought it was set up and run real well, and most legislators seemed to be afraid to go in and tell them what they thought.
Yeah.
And it didn't bother me a bit, and they welcomed me with both open arms. And
of course, you knew Speaker Graybill a little bit.
Oh, sure.
From Great Falls.
He was one of the ones that was instigating getting me run in the first place.
Well, good.
Huh. Yeah, that was kind of interesting. The first time I ever ran for the legislature, I got talked into it by the fellow Democrats. Went home, told my wife I'd file for the legislature, and she said, "Oh, fine, I'm going to file for divorce."
Did you happen to be at a meeting of some kind where some fellows came up and approached you and asked you to run?
No, I was just Leo Graybill was the big one. You know,
the
Democratic Central Committee. You know, we're looking for candidates, and he called me into my office one day, or in his office one day, and just asked me if I would run, and I wasn't very eager about it. But
well, why would he have come to you? What had you done? Were you involved in politics?
Well, you know, I was real active in the Cascade County Farmers Union, and another local issue we had up there. We had a old folks' home that was really a mess up there, and I was one of the big pushers in there to finally get a new Cascade County hospital built, and that was one of the ways I think I got more acquainted countywide, and we had to, you know, circulate a petition to get it on the ballot. And we got it approved overwhelmingly, you might say.
Well, good.
It was, before that, on that old folks home, you know, the county commissioners were running it, and they were getting a rake off of the cost, and it was a pretty pathetic situation. So we got the whole mess straightened out.
Got it straightened out.
Yeah.
And so your dad was a legislator, and your brother had been a legislator.
Yeah.
And there was a woman by the name of Gunderson who was in the legislature, wasn't there?
Yeah, my sister-in-law ran for the legislature from up at Haver.
Yeah.
Harold had moved up to Haver, and then she ran and got elected up there and served one term. So,
so there have been several Gundersons over the years that have
like
served.
Gordon McCumber, he always says that he served with four different Gundersons.
Okay, well, that's good. Before, I'm interested in the maybe some of your thoughts and observations when your dad was a legislator, but before we do that, let's talk a little bit about your experience at the Constitutional Convention. And I've asked you for your overall impression of it and that sort of thing. But you served, as I did, on both sides of the Constitution. You served before the Constitution the 72 Constitution went into effect and after it went into effect.
Mm-hmm.
I was there just for one session before it went into effect, but you were there for several on either side of it. Any thoughts about the legislature before the 72 Constitution and the legislature afterwards? Anything that as a legislator, from a legislator's perspective, the Constitution seemed to change for better or worse?
Well, like I said earlier, it seemed like, from 65 through that time, every time we'd have a bill of some importance would come up, you'd always run into this old Constitution, you could or you couldn't do it. And and then afterwards, well, after the Con, I carried a whole batch of bills, you know, to implement.
Okay.
Remember that? Oh, God, we must have 40 or 50 bills to implement the new Constitution. Remember Joella Esteson, she was a researcher for him, and, she wrote a lot of those bills or the changes, and I carried a lot of those for her. But I carried mostly the education bills because I was on the education. I don't know if I was chairman at that time or not, but I carried a lot of those bills, which, you know, with no particular problem or anything, but you just had to make all these changes in the law and to fit the new constitution over the old one.
But I suppose this is a question that the answer is obvious, but you feel that an improvement resulted from the new constitution?
Oh, yeah, definitely. You know, it just seemed like, I suppose then we started modeling whatever legislation we had at that time, you know, to fit the new constitution.
Yeah.
And, you know, we just didn't have the problems where we were running into the old Constitution. You never could get anything changed.
We're just now completing, in fact, today, literally, the 2005 legislative session has adjourned sine die. Today, as we speak, just happened a few hours ago. But they'll have to meet again in special session in order to address the problem of school funding. And the school funding issue was brought before the legislature as the result of a decision of the Montana State Supreme Court interpreting the 1972 Constitution to mean that the legislature has inequitably and inadequately funded public education, because ours is one of the few constitutions in the country that specifically mentions education and mentions that the people are entitled to a quality education. And of course, there's been a lot of difference of opinion about exactly what that means. But so our Constitution has directly affected our expenditures, our priorities, our method and level of taxation, the money we allocate to public schools and other things. And that probably wouldn't have happened. I imagine it wouldn't have happened under the 1889 Constitution.
Oh, I'm sure it wouldn't have. But, you know, it was just a matter of when was the original Constitution written? In 1895?
1889.
Yeah. Sorry, 18.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, things were so much different at that time. And, you know, the perspective, I think, of everybody in the state had changed, and they wanted these different things done. That the old one just had you had your hands tied on it, so you couldn't do anything on it. But I you know, was very real, real happy. I thought they had an outstanding, you know, and that was one of the better things, that they didn't let legislators run for it.
Yes, that's right. So legislators were ineligible to run for delegates to the Constitutional Convention.
Yeah. And like I say, I think that's where it scared out a lot of legislators, even going up to testify.
Yeah.
But, you know, I just figured, you know, the things I was interested in, my perspective on it, and they were happy to, you know, to hear my thoughts on it. And
sure.
I think they adopted a lot of things that I thought should be in the new one. I can't think of any specific thing like that. But I spent quite a bit of time up here.
Did you see any other legislators that you can recall that were up there at that same time?
Very, very few. You know, like I say, I think they, you know, where they wouldn't let legislators be delegates to it. I think it just kind of, they were hesitant about coming up and expressing an opinion. But
yeah,
I think they would have been just as welcome as I was, you know, in specific areas.
Jack, in your observations of the Constitutional Convention, were there Constitutional Convention delegates that stand out in your mind?
Oh, yeah, there always is. You know, Dorothy Eck, for one, was who was Rick Champeau?
Rick Champeau from the Flathead?
From the Flathead. And
what was it about Dorothy Eck and Rick Champeau that are memorable to you?
Well, I can't even remember now. Rick, was he chairman of the Education Committee?
Yes,
I think so. And Dorothy, just, you know, all the way around, all the issues, she had a liberal viewpoint, I guess, that I agreed with. And, I thought they had a lot of, you know, I'd say out of the total bunch, there was probably 30 or 40, you know, outstanding ones.
Yeah.
And it's kind of like the legislature, you know, there's usually about 30, 40 people that kind of are the leaders on it and bring out the ideas, and the rest of them.
Yeah.
You know, it's not that they're not good legislators, but they're not, you know, leaders or in the forefront.
Or thinkers or people that make things happen. I think that's true.
Yeah.
Going back to your early life, your dad served in the House in the 1940s from Cascade County, from roughly 1940 to 1950, is that what you said?
Yeah, about that period.
And so were you able to visit him in the legislature? Did you come down here to Helena during legislative sessions?
Well, not too much, because I was the one that got stuck running the farm up there while he's in politics.
Oh, I see.
And really, I wasn't that interested in it, because, you know, he was gone so darn much, you know, with all the legislature.
Now, Sam Ford was governor during most of that period.
Yeah, and Hugo Aronson.
And John Bonner.
Yeah, Bonner.
Do you remember your dad talking about Ford? Do you remember any, do you have any impressions of Governor Ford?
Well, I'm sure he probably served with Ford, you know, when he first got elected, but I know he got along good with Hugo Aronson. I think Hugo appointed him to some state committee to study property taxes to come up with some kind of an answer. And
I see.
I can't remember that they ever came up with anything that changed much what they had before.
And then do you remember anything about Governor Bonner or him mentioning Governor Bonner?
Well, my dad was a great supporter of Bonner. I know that. And he was a great supporter of Arnold Olson, too. And Arnold ran for Attorney General. And, well, he's a supporter of Forrest Anderson. Arnold.
Yeah.
You know, he knew all those guys real well, which I knew him. But, you know, like I say, I
was... Do you have it? What's your first memory or your first recollection of Governor Bonner?
Oh, golly, I can't really remember, but I know Frank Murray, you know, he was always running, and he's always around every political meeting all the time.
Do you remember being at a meeting with Frank Murray, or Secretary of State Frank Murray?
Not so much, but
Arnold Olson?
One of the first impressions I remember from politics, I was back at the old Ritz Theater when... Who was it? Erickson ran for the Senate or ran for governor?
Yeah, 1934 when Erickson was running for the Senate against Murray in the primary, Democratic primary.
Yeah, I can't remember. It seemed like he was running for against somebody for governor.
Well, he was last elected governor in 1932.
Yeah.
Could that have been the year?
But I remember, though, he gave, a really thumping, pounding speech.
Really?
Yeah, that really impressed me. I always did like him after that.
You know, Jack, that's interesting because he's from my hometown of Kalispell, or where I went to high school. Johnny Erickson was a district judge in Kalispell, and he ran for governor in 1924 for the first time as a Democrat, and he defeated Joe Dixon. And Joe Dixon was a very independent-minded Republican. Maybe you read something about him or remember something about him in the history of the politics of the state. But at least, according to historians, Erickson was very close to the Anaconda Company during the period of time when he was governor. And the Anaconda Company was interested in defeating Dixon because Dixon was trying to tax him.
Yeah.
And so Erickson was elected governor with the support of the Anaconda Company in 1924, reelected in 28, and again, elected again in 32. He was one of the, I think he was the only person in Montana history that was elected governor three consecutive times. And then went on in 1934 to run for the U.S. Senate. He'd actually arranged to have himself appointed to the U.S. Senate when Senator Walsh died. Mm-hmm. So the speech you probably heard, my guess is, if he's running for governor, would have been in 1932, because that's the last time he ran for governor. And then he ran in the primary in 34. He could have given speeches for other Democratic candidates, too, after that.
Yeah, like I say, that's a long time ago.
But you remember him as a good public speaker?
Yeah, well, I can remember that particular speech that he gave down there. And
what was memorable about it?
Well, just that he was such a dynamic speaker, and and the issues he put up, I can't remember what the issues were.
But he was dynamic and impressive, you remember about him. And of course, he was a big man with a big mane of white hair, and probably looked kind of impressive, too.
That's like Mike Mansfield, when he used to give those Jackson Day dinners. He'd really get wound up and, really would impress anybody that was in the place, even if you were a leaning Republican. I think when you left the dinner, you'd vote for Mike Mansfield. But Metcalf used to be able to give a pretty good speech like that, too, at our
Democratic dinner.
Yeah.
So you were brought up, you went to a fair number of Democratic dinners as a kid.
Oh, sure.
and Jack, how would you characterize your political philosophy? Because I think you were actively involved in the Farmers Union, your family's been involved in the Democratic Party. What are the core beliefs that you have? How would you describe your philosophy?
Well, it goes back, I think, to even the 30s, and where I always got the support. We did get this farm labor political action committee where Farmers Union and the labor union would sit down and discuss the issues and take stands on them, and pretty well control politics like Cascade County at that time. It's to get farmers a decent living, labor a decent decent wage.
So that's what they had in common.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, they knew that if the agriculture couldn't make money, labor couldn't get wages. And same token, if you wanted a decent help, you had to pay them a decent wage.
Yeah. Now, the Farm Labor Coalition existed in Montana. I think it existed in Minnesota. It existed in North Dakota, I think, to some extent. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure it does so much anymore. Do you have any thoughts on that? At least as far as Montana's concerned?
Well, I don't know. You know, just both, the Farmers Union has lost membership because the people are moving off the land. Land getting bigger and fewer and far between. And then now I think what's tragic is the AFL-CIO has just completely switched their philosophy.
How do you see that now?
Well, I don't know. They have just changed their attitude that to get jobs for their workers in Montana, they've just gotten in bed with the big industries and big companies.
Do you think it's possible that a labor union could still be a strong advocate of workers' rights and at the same time be open to letting businesses expand so more jobs can be created?
Oh, sure, because I belong to this Progressive Labor Party now, and unlike some of the things we've discussed there with, they're against the environmentalists all the time, and Progressive Labor has taken the attitude that you'd probably create more jobs with strong environment, in the cleanup and follow-up and doing it in a proper way to start with than just going in and demolishing, like a mountain or something.
And
you have a problem on your hands like you have up at Landusky that you'll be fighting for the next 100 years.
Now, Landusky is where there's a mine that wasn't properly reclaimed. It's been a controversial
thing. Well, they
just
tore that all apart, and they didn't have half the money to go in and do the reclamation. And they've done a lot of work up there, but I don't know, they just can't seem to solve the water problem, with all those open piles and stuff that natural moisture comes through and it picks up all the pollutants out of the spoil piles and the open cuts and everything else.
That kind of an issue, there was a lot of mining that went on in Montana in the 40s and 50s and 60s when the labor and the farmers union were together. And the mines were functioning in Butte, the sawmills were functioning in the western part of the state. A lot of the employees of the mines and in the sawmills were labor union members, probably mostly voted a Democratic ticket. Mm-hmm. Now that there are a few sawmills still in operation, now that there are a few mines in operation, there aren't as many of those unionized workers any longer voting the Democratic ticket. And at least as a partial consequence of that, the Democratic Party hasn't had as much success the last 10 or 15 years in Montana politics as before. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't know, why any working man, they always bring this up. Well, there's been corruptions in unions, I don't know particularly in Montana, but, that they're squandering their union dues on, like with the Teamsters nationally and this and that. And I know some of these people I don't know if the times are that much tougher, but I don't know how much their dues were, but that was their objection to us, that their dues weren't being spent in the way that they thought they should be. And then these companies are smart enough, we'll pay over union scale if you'll drop the union.
Sure, yeah.
And they got their ways of convincing people, and like a worker would sooner have the $10 in his paycheck for his dues to go buy a new camper as to think 20 years ahead about his pension plan or something like that. That just seems to me like what's happened on it.
But do you think, though, that when in the period when basically you had labor on one side and management on the other side, generally Democrats won the elections, when that ceased to be such an important issue, and when the issues were more social issues and more environmental issues, maybe that divided farmers and the labor movement and that sort of thing. I'm not sure I understand that, but it seems as though our politics has really changed as a result of that, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, I think the environmental movement came through where a lot of the workers felt like by the environmental stopping certain mines, they were going to raise hell with the countryside by you know, they could see their jobs were showing up. And I think it's still true, you know, like even out here, what's this mine out here at Clancy, you know, they expanded that, but those, you know, are really good paying jobs out there, $50,000-$60,000 a year. And anytime the environmentalists say, hey, come on now, you got to clean up this mess, or you can't do this because it is making a mess, why then those people getting those salaries like that immediately, so I think flipped over Republican.
Yeah. Jack, one of the things I'm especially interested in our interview today is your perspective on the role in Montana politics of the Anaconda Company. Historians, of course, write in many cases that the Anaconda Company had a dominating influence in the politics of our state from the early 1900s into the, well, probably into the 60s or 70s, the 1960s or 70s. Any thoughts on that?
Well, I know, you know, back when my dad was in the legislature in the 40s, you know, they were in full force then. And I remember one of the issues he always shook up over is the
silicosis.
Yeah. You know, and he always felt like the ACM should be paying that to the taxpayers in Montana. And I know he fought that all the way through his legislative years. And it's still around, I think, as far as I know.
You know, it's interesting that you should mention that, because when I first came to the legislature, there was a fella that served in your delegation from Cascade County by the name of M.F. Keller. And Keller was a Republican who chaired the Public Health Committee. Mm-hmm. And so as a new freshman legislator, I was put on the Public Health Committee. That wasn't a committee that most of us wanted to be on. So a lot of times that was a committee where freshmen would be placed. And there was a bill that had something to do with silicosis benefits that came into that committee. And I remember leaving the committee meeting that day and Keller telling me, he said, well, Bob, as a practical matter, this is something that never should have been the responsibility of the state of Montana. This should always have been taken care of by the Anaconda Company.
Sure.
That's what he told me. He was a Republican. Now, you're a Democrat telling me that you and your dad basically think the same thing.
Well, like old J.D. Lynch, you know, even before I left there, you know, every year they'd come in, well, there's only 100 old silicotic widows there, you only need $100,000 and they're dying off, and the next session you come back, there'd be 250.
Yeah.
Increase that.
But the state continued to do that. Yeah. In fact, I think that's why is it Galen? There was a state institution at Galen for people with lung ailments that I think was
probably mostly due to that.
Mostly due to that, yeah. Sure, yeah. I think that's right.
Well, and then that metal mines tax, that was always a big issue clear back through there. You know, I think the Democrats are always trying to, you know, get that increased, which they were violently opposed to that. But at my years in the legislature, you know, I was in 65, I remember, it was probably the last year they used to have the watering hole down at the Placer Hotel, and I might have been up there one or two, I can't remember. But that was about the time their power started downhill. But the ACM and the power company, you know, where the ACM went downhill, the power company just stepped right into the void. And
did you see that the Montana Power Company and the Anaconda Company is pretty close together?
Oh, yeah, they were like Goldust twins. And
yeah.
But, you know, just speaking about those water holes, you probably remember them. But, I mean, I never had any objection to them whatsoever, because that was the one place, like, members of the House would mix with the members of the Senate, and you know, we'd talk over different things where, you know, nowadays, I don't know if the House members down here even know the senators. You know, they just don't seem to have any mix there to where they get to know each other. And heck, we used to talk over, you know, all the bills all the time, not that we ever made deals particularly, but you got to know the issues and why the guy was doing this, and he'd listen to your side of it too.
Yeah.
There was a lot less, you know, fighting and acrimony, or I guess you'd say.
The watering holes maybe provided a sort of a melting pot for Democrats, Republican senators, representatives, city boys and country boys to get together and have a cocktail and eat a sandwich and kind of get acquainted with each other.
Sure.
And when they're not there anymore, people go their different directions at the end of the day, and there's maybe not as much opportunity for that.
Sure. Well,
was the Placer Hotel still a... was that still the common meeting place when you first got here?
Yeah, I think that 65 session was probably the last one.
Well, the fellow I interviewed just before you, Jack, was Norris Nichols. And he mentioned that kind of the same thing. He said he didn't know that there were any places that you could go to. But he said then the Placer Hotel, whether it was the so-called water holes or whether it was just the bar or the lobby or wherever, but most everybody hung out at some time or other around the Placer Hotel. It was kind of the common meeting place for the whole legislature, at least when he was here in the 50s and maybe up into the 60s. And there doesn't seem to be a place like that now as we speak in the early, after 2000.
Well, I don't know. You know, then after that was closed up, they moved those watering holes up to Jorgensen's. And I don't know, for some reason, I don't know when the Colonial was, when Babcock built the Colonial, yeah, but Democrats kind of congregated at Jorgensen's.
Right.
And the Republicans are always out at the Colonial.
Yeah, yeah, that's right. And I remember that too. That's my first clear recollection.
Sure.
I'm told that there were watering holes at Jorgensen's, which is a hotel, I suppose a mile or two east of the old Placer Hotel down in Last Chance Gulch. But when I arrived here in 1971, I don't have any recollection of them.
Of the Colonial?
Well, yeah, I remember the Colonial, but I don't remember. I've heard about the watering holes at the Placer, and I've heard that they briefly were at Jorgensen's after they closed them down at the Placer. But when I got here in 71, I never was to one if they were still there in 71.
Well, you know, that might be a result of the con too. That,
could be.
That, you know, that... Because that's about the time I think they closed them up, and
yeah,
then, you know, that switched over to where Democrats had congregated at Jorgensen's, but the watering holes I think ended about that time.
About that time, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, another thing too, we talk about the new Constitution and the legislature and how it changed, and maybe that the legislature is a little more partisan now, that legislators don't know each other as well now. Any thoughts on term limitations?
Oh, I think that was one of the mistakes, and then I'll tell you the biggest mistake I ever made, I think, in the legislature, although your hands were tied on that, but I was really a supporter of single-member district. In fact, Tom Tao and I, we stayed up for a week before in the morning drawing the first single-member district map, and, you know, my idea was that you'd know everybody in your district,
yeah,
your district, like we were elected, you know, countywide before that. But I don't know, I think when they went to single-member districts, they ceased to be state legislators. They were district representatives.
Yeah.
All they care about is representing their district and kind of lose the picture, the big picture, what's good for the state of Montana.
You have a narrower view, I think that's true. Yeah, I think that is true.
Yeah. But we have no choice, because the Supreme Court ruling, one man, one vote.
Yeah. And you have to make that work out, obviously,
yeah,
that's true. You mentioned Governor Aaronson, and of course your dad had some experience with him. Did you ever meet him personally?
Oh yeah, I met him. I know he was he was governor, and I had some state land leased. And at that time, you know, the state insisted that harvest time you haul your wheat in regardless of the price, and it just made me mad. So I came up to a land board meeting, and Hugo was governor, and I think Forrest Anderson was the attorney general, and I explained what was going to happen. I said, you know, they know that all the state wheat's going to be sold that day, so naturally the price, or, you know, that period of years. And I just got it so that, you know, a landowner or producer could take out a wheat loan just like they do on their own and hold it until the price went up.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah, and Hugo, that makes sense. And Forrest Anderson had land board adopted it. Just,
well,
no,
great.
No problem at all, which I think over the years it's made state a lot of money.
Oh, yeah. Was that your idea?
Yeah, because, you know, I just knew what was going on.
Well, that's why Leo Grabel came to you and said, Jack, you ought to run for the legislature.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I've had a lot of fun, you know, with different things. Like, I've fought the federal farm program clear back to Washington, D.C. a couple times too, and every time I did, I won. You know, they come out with some bureaucratic rule that just don't make sense. And you sit down with those people and explain what's going on, really, and they have no problem at all getting them to agree with you and get changes made.
Yeah. Governor Nutter.
Well, he was one of the reasons, I think, that I did run, too, because, well, he must have got elected, what, in 60 or 60?
1960.
But you remember, they came in and just cut the budget, and And boy, I tell you, all the state buildings and institutions really got beat bad. And I know the first year I was in 65, we went over to Warm Springs, and good Lord, they had people stacked up three high in the hallways, and you could hardly stand the smell in there. And like I always say, in Francis Barton, who I think would agree too, it took us about four sessions to make up for that drastic cutback they had, you know, where they didn't repair buildings, they didn't do
that. Was 1961.
Yeah.
How would you compare then, say, Nutter to the governors on either side of him, to Aaronson and to Babcock? Was Nutter different than the other two?
Well, he just had this philosophy, no government all cut it to bare bones, or, you know, Hugo, I think he went along and realized people had to have services, the institutions had to be kept up, and I think Babcock, after Nutter's big cutback, that, you know, you still have to provide certain services to people in Montana, regardless of if you have to increase taxes.
Yeah. Did you ever meet Nutter?
Oh, I think I met him, but I never had any dealings with
him. Do you have an impression of him?
Yeah, that he was just an anti-government person.
Yeah, philosophically, but I mean, if somebody was asked you to describe him as a person, would you say he was dynamic, opinionated,
well, he was opinionated.
Impressive, conservative? Did you have a close enough experience with him to form an impression like that?
Well, I really didn't have that close enough. I just judged by what he did, and he was opinionated, conservative, eliminate government.
Yeah.
About what it amounted.
Now, you certainly knew Governor Babcock.
Oh, yeah.
What are your thoughts and impressions of him?
Oh, I don't know. He was just kind of an average governor, I think. He didn't do anything either way too drastically. And I got along with him okay. You know, I never had any too much direct conflict with him. But
no,
I know he. I think we used to fight the school foundation program every year, and they always wanted to keep it down. And
yeah,
we kept saying, "Look at these school costs are there, and you got to fund them."
And you were chairman of the education committee in the House for some of those years too, weren't you?
Well, two sessions. I was about 70. 5 and 77, I think. But that was just an accident. Nobody else wanted to be on the education when I first started, so like you got stuck on.
I had the same job in the Senate, that's right.
You know, and you build up seniority, you
sure.
Pick your chairman.
That's right. Do you have any, you worked with the School Boards Association, the MEA?
Well, the MEA, D. Cooper was head of that, and then I forget who was it, his numbers man all the time, but they were real good as far as, you know,
helping you understand school funding and that sort of thing. Yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
You know, and the foundation program, how it worked and why you have to.
Was John Board involved at that point?
Well, John, I think he was head of MEA.
Yeah, that's what I thought I remembered too.
Not that first. Well, in fact, I ran against John Board. I think I beat him in 65, or, you know, not directly, but I think he ran as a Republican that time, and I ran as a Democrat. And John Board and I were always a good friend. I think he, over the years, I think he's a good Democrat now.
Yeah, I think he probably is now, too, yeah. Now, you mentioned you had an early experience with Governor Anderson, that you remember him when he was Attorney General and and so on. And was that the experience you just told me about?
Well, that was on that, when I had that appeared on the land board. You know, he's a member of the land board that time, but I remember Forrest, so he came up with that governmental reorganization.
Yeah.
Which I supported, but I still don't think it ever did a damn thing.
And that was the 20 is plenty idea, right?
Yeah.
That we needed to only have, what was it, a maximum of 20 departments of state government.
Yeah. And it really looked good on paper, but I can't see that I ever did a darn thing, can you?
Well, you had more experience, because you see, when I came in, I didn't really hardly know what happened before then.
Yeah.
Because I arrived in the 1971 legislative session, I think that's when we implemented 20 is plenty.
Yeah, that was about right.
So I guess I don't know that much about what occurred before then, but apparently there were a lot of independent state agencies that
They were, but they were directly responsible to the people too. Where now, sure. You know, like the Hale Board come under the Department of Agriculture.
Yeah.
So now you got to go through the director of the Department of Agriculture to get to the Hale Board.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think it saved anything at all, and I think it took a lot away from people instead of getting more direct. His idea is like if you had a problem with the Hale Board, you go to the Commissioner of Agriculture, and that would take care of everything.
Yeah.
Go to the Commissioner of Agriculture, the Director of Agriculture, and he can do what he wants one way or other. He can either help you a lot or else he can steer you off someplace.
But when you look at the arrows and the lines and the boxes on the organizational chart, it looks pretty good.
Oh, it really looks good. But when you come to dealing with it, I think you got more bureaucracy now than you had before. You have to go through more people to get to where you want to.
And I remember Governor Anderson, several things about him, because he was governor when I first arrived in the legislature, but I remember certainly that he pushed strongly for this governmental reorganization concept. Mm-hmm. And I think if it hadn't been for his bold leadership in that regard, that probably wouldn't have happened.
No, that was pretty...
Now, so we've talked a little bit about Governor Aronson, and I think your description of him was kind of a big... good-natured sort of a guy,
mm-hmm.
who probably didn't have a real radical political philosophy one way or another. That Governor Nutter was a pretty much a hardcore conservative ideologue with a strong personality.
Yeah.
That Governor Babcock was maybe a little more like Governor Aronson. How would you characterize Governor Anderson?
Well, he was very, very opinionated and wanted things his way, but he knew his politics. And you know, back in those years, I don't know, did you ever get caught up in one of these special sessions?
Yeah.
And I don't know, when I first started the legislature, I think we got $10 a day for 60 days, and that
yeah.
was it.
Yeah.
And I remember we really had a battle over the budget. And was that when we come, what the heck was it? On the surtax?
Yeah, we had that was 71. And the Republicans in the House wanted a sales tax.
Yeah.
The Democrats in the Senate wanted an income tax.
Yeah, about a 35% increase.
A big increase in the income tax. The Republicans were opposing a 2% sales tax, and that had raised about as much money as a 35% increase in the income tax. And of course, Anderson would have vetoed the sales tax, but it reached him anyway. So the Republicans were really on a almost a hopeless kind of a situation, but. Anyway, we pushed for it. I was a Republican legislator at the time. And ultimately what happened was the legislature was supposed to have met for 60 days, and we met for something like 107 or 108 days. And it just went on, and it didn't appear as though the impasse could be broken. And so finally what happened was we put the matter
on
the ballot before the people, and the people voted for the 35% income tax increase in lieu of a 2% sales tax.
Yeah. Yeah, those were tough old sessions.
Do you remember much about that sales tax?
Oh, debate? Yeah, when, who was it, Felt? Wasn't he the big push
on it? In 67.
Yeah.
And that had raised about as much money as a 35% increase in the income tax. And of course, Anderson would have vetoed the sales tax, but it reached him anyway, so the Republicans were really on a almost a hopeless kind of a situation, but anyway, we pushed for it. I was a Republican legislator at the time, and ultimately what happened was the legislature was supposed to have met for 60 days, and we met for something like 107 or 108 days, and it just went on, and there was it didn't appear as though the impasse could be broken, and so finally what happened was we put the matter
on
the ballot before the people, and the people voted for the 35% income tax increase in lieu of a 2% sales tax.
Yeah, those were tough old sessions.
Do you remember much about that sales tax?
Oh, yeah, when, who was it, Felt? Wasn't he the big push on it?
In 67.
Yeah.
And in 71, when I was there, Lucas was the speaker. And he was a supporter of it. And the fellow that carried the bill was a young representative from Helena here by the name of George Bennett.
Yeah. But I remember that first one that Felt was a big push on it, you know, and God, it was a bill, you know, probably 50, 60, 80 pages, and nobody could understand what was all in it.
Yeah.
I remember Larry Fassbender was just a freshman legislator, and Pat Gilfiller, I think, was the one that really fought it too. And it, between him and Larry, he would start asking Felt, "Well, does this, how is this, what does it do with a cast on your leg, for instance? Is that taxed or isn't taxed?" And they just died. Well, John Hall was around too.
Yeah. Somebody, I think, mentioned to me, I missed out on this. This might have been in 67, but they figured out that the sales tax, as it had been drawn, would tax Girl Scout cookies.
Yeah.
And they made a big thing out of that. Remember that?
Oh, yeah. Well, just different things than that. You know, yeah. They just didn't really have everything tied down exactly what they were.
Jack, what would the philosophical argument against the sales tax be?
It's just a darn nuisance of it. I mean, personally, I'd be better off with the sales tax. You know, it was like your groceries and stuff.
They'd be exempted in most sales tax.
Yeah.
Groceries would be, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, like on a farm, like if you had to pay a sales tax on a $100,000 tractor,
yeah,
or cars and things, yeah, like that, it's just a, you know, when I buy something, I like to buy it, it's mine, that's it. You know, that have taxed something.
Montana is one of just, I don't know, three or four states that doesn't have a sales tax.
Yeah.
And most sales taxes in most states have been implemented by Democratic legislatures and Democratic governors. Yeah. And yet in Montana, our tradition has been for the Democrats to oppose the sales tax and the Republicans to support it.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that?
Oh, I don't know. I think it's just that...
It can't just be this nuisance thing, can it?
Yeah, it's a nuisance thing to me, plus then...
But isn't there a deeper philosophical issue?
I think so, because people just don't like the idea, you know, if you're going to go... bottle of milk is a dollar.
Yeah.
They don't want to have to pay $1.03 for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you know, from the viewpoint of someone who believes in government, you know, that there's more revenue for government if they pay the 3 cents.
Yeah, but there's, you know, there's I'm a great one on the income tax. If I make money,
yeah,
I'll be damn, I'm real happy to pay my tax on it. But if I'm not making money, how do you pay the tax?
So that's the philosophical argument?
That's mine, anyway.
Okay.
You know, like, I had no problem at all with that 35% income tax increase, because if I'm making money, I can pay it. If I'm not, I don't have to pay it.
I see, okay.
You know, like, I remember 1 year, I think we left here, we had $40,000 balance in the state budget. I think it was $40,000.
Gosh, oh,
Pat Bilweather gets up on the floor and says, one hailstorm across the triangle will wipe out our surplus.
Wipe out the entire surplus?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sure he was right. Yeah, I'm sure he was right.
But Bill Groff, you know, and...
Senator Bill Groff from Ravalli County.
Yeah. Oh, Senator Groff and Stan Deese and Dave James and...
Other senators from up in the Highlands, Senator Stanley Neese and Senator Dave James.
Yeah, yeah.
What about them?
Well, they had been around here a long time, and they, you know, and I would go for them for advice, and they knew what was going on and saved me getting in a lot of trouble.
They were good advisors to you when you were a young legislator.
They'd be like, sit down and talk to you. I know I'd be up there about 7 every morning, and Stan Neese and Dave James and some of those old boys are around. We'd sit and... They'd tell me what facts of life.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was a lot of good old boys around at that time.
I remember once I befriended Dave James a little bit too when I was a young legislator, and he seemed like such a proper gentleman. That's always how he was around me. And he told me a funny story. He said sometimes the guys would go into the cloakroom in the Senate, and they'd have a bottle of whiskey or two in their lockers, and they'd have a cocktail in the afternoon, sometimes even when there was a floor session going on, out of the sight of the public and the reporters and so on.
Oh,
they're
sure.
In the cloakroom. And he said it wasn't even uncommon for them to, you know, have a, maybe come up there in the evening and drink a little bit in the cloakroom, or maybe at the end of the day. And so apparently this happened maybe at the end of the legislative session one day, and there were two bottles of whiskey, one with a little whiskey still left in it and the other one empty, and some paper cups or something laying around, and the place was not real well cleaned up. And this was in the cloakroom. And he said that he had some folks from his hometown of Joplin that were there coming to visit the legislature. And he said, well, look, he said, I've got a committee that meets first thing in the morning. But he said, if you want me to give you a quick kind of a, just a quick tour of the legislative process, let's do it early. So they met someplace for breakfast, and then they were following him upstairs. Or no, I think he was... Somehow he was in the cloakroom And they came through the back door, and there they were going to meet him in the cloakroom, mm-hmm. and then he'd take him around the Capitol building at that time. So he just walked in the cloakroom, and like 30 seconds later, they walked in the door, and there Dave is standing by this half-empty bottle of whiskey on the coffee table with the other one empty and paper cups laying around and that sort of thing. And he wasn't much of a drinker. In fact, I think he was a pretty straight-laced kind of a guy. Said I was embarrassed, and I had to explain to him they looked at him like, oh, you're up here having your eye opener, you know, and didn't expect us to walk in. But the janitor must not have done a good job of cleaning up the night before. Maybe he was going to come in and get us first thing in the morning. I don't know. But anyway, he was a very kindly and wise old gentleman. I remember that. He just died here a couple of years ago.
Yeah, you know, is Fred Barrett still alive?
I don't know that. But when I was a young legislator here also, Fred Barrett introduced me to his father-in-law, a fellow named Leonard Plank, who had served in the Senate, I think, back in the late 20s and early 30s. And I had a great visit with him once about the early legislature.
Oh, I was thinking that Dave James was, you know, related to Fred Barrett.
Could be. I didn't know that.
Yeah, I'm not sure of it either.
Yeah, that could be.
But there was a lot of good old guys. You know, like Miles Romney was always one of my favorites around here. And
what is it about Miles Romney that you find most memorable?
Well, he just was a good liberal thinker, and you know, that being editor of that paper, you know, he was well versed in a lot of these issues, and he was the one, you know, that first came up with the coal tax.
Yeah,
I remember. I don't know if I was a freshman or sophomore, but I think they were taxing it at 3 cents a ton.
Yeah,
and they had a bill, I think, to raise it to 5, and he couldn't get anybody to sign it. And I said, "Hell, I'll sign it with you." And he said then, you know, there's a sleeping giant in Montana that's going to be worth millions and billions. And boy, how right he was.
Well, how right he was, no question about that. When you say he was a liberal thinker, can you think of issues that he was associated with that would leave that impression about him with you?
Well, I don't know. You know, he was always active in the farm labor movement, too. You know, I think that's where I knew a lot about him before. And then, you know, Harry Billings, the old people's voice.
Yeah.
You know, they were pretty much the same thoughts all the way through. But that farm labor organization, you know, between Miles' paper, too, that made a big difference.
Yeah.
In Montana, and then the people's voice. I mean, the Republicans used to hate it. But boy, they'd be right now what old Harry Billings was, you know, was thinking about particular bills, and boy, he'd lay it on somebody, too.
Now, the Anaconda Company owned the newspapers in the state.
Yeah, he had all
the major dailies, with the exception of the Great Falls
Tribune.
And so, but here you have Miles Romney, who was an independent weekly newspaper owner, mm-hmm. and you've mentioned Harry Billings. So, you know, we talked a little bit about the Anaconda Company before, but we characterized both of these people as liberals. Harry Billings and Miles Romney would be liberals.
Mm-hmm.
And their reason for being, perhaps, was to create some kind of an independent voice from the Anaconda Company. Is that accurate, do you think?
Yeah, to get a voice for, you know, both labor and farmers on the issues that were important at that time. And, you know, I think that's where the ACM used to, well, the Butte Miners Union, or that was a that was a bloody warfare between the ACM and the workers down there all the time. But, you know, the ACM used to be able to control that Butte delegation. How they could do it, I don't know.
Yeah. Because they were solidly Democrats, solidly pro-labor union delegation. But it's come up in several of my interviews that they generally were pretty heavily influenced by the Anaconda Company.
Oh, yeah, I think the Anaconda picked them out, and you vote with us and we'll get you elected. What happened down there?
How do you think they had that influence in Butte?
How did the
Anaconda Company have more influence than the FFL-CIO in Butte? Maybe that's not accurate, but
well, I think it's just a matter of money. Like now, you know, they'd actually go buy votes, I think, if they had to get their boys elected. And well, you know enough about some of that early vote fraud in Montana.
Yeah, I've read some things, and I think we were around some of that, or we could have been. But you know, there's the old saying, was it W.A. Clark was supposed to have said, I don't know if he actually said it, I never bought a man who wasn't for sale.
Yeah.
So I suppose if you were dishonest, and you were kind of behaving that way around the halls of the Capitol building, maybe somebody would offer you a bribe.
Yeah.
You know, but if you didn't ever give any indication that you'd accept one or they were interested in that sort of thing, you'd probably never even know what happened. That'd be my guess, anyway.
Well, like, you know, down at the old Placer, when they're in their heydays, you know, they used to say you leave their transom open, throw the money over the transom,
yeah,
and
yeah,
get their way with it.
Yeah. Well, I don't think anything nearly that flagrant occurred when we were here, but I don't know.
No, well, I think, you know...
Did your dad ever speak of anything like that in the 40s? Did he ever suspect anything like that?
Oh, I think I think it was going on, and, you know, and I can't remember, you know, ever directly, or, you know, the guy got paid off, but, you know, some good people come up here and be elected a real good liberal member, and pretty quick, boy, they just lose them.
Yeah.
One way or another, between booze and money and
yeah,
women.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Any Republicans that stand out in your memory?
Oh, yeah. Like, I always got along real good with Bill Mathers. He was chairman of the Senate Education Committee and I was chairman of the House. and he'd have trouble with Republicans over there and I'd have trouble with Democrats or vice versa. And tell him, oh, hell, if you're having trouble there, send it over. We'll take care of it the same token. And
yeah.
I thought he was one of the better Republicans I ever knew in my life.
It was a very reasonable man.
I
had a great experience with him, too.
Yeah.
In fact, he followed Gordon McCumber as president of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
And they had a similar leadership style.
Yeah, I think so. Kind of low-key and try and work it out rather than fight it out.
Yeah, that's right. What do you remember about Jim Lucas?
Well, Jim, I thought, was always, you know, pretty fair. But, you know, it was me a Democrat and him a Republican. But he was an eloquent speaker. But we had John Hall at that time, and those two guys used to... that was fun to sit out and listen to him.
Do you remember the great... what was it about? There was a debate that had something to do with the coal development.
I don't really remember.
It was a night session, and it was between basically the two main gladiators. There were other people involved in it, but the two main gladiators were Lucas and Hall.
Yeah.
Do you remember that?
I can't remember what the issue was, but I can remember those two debating, you know, and John Hall used to be just sitting there, you know, they'd think he'd be working a crossword or puzzle or something, and the Republicans would think, you know, they'd catch him off guard, and he knew everything word that was said, and he'd get up and give an hour speech when they thought he was half asleep.
Yeah.
Oh, he was one of the most brilliant men I think I ever saw. But
John Hall was a minority leader in the House of Representatives, a Democrat from Cascade County. I think my first session there, perhaps, in 71.
That's probably about right.
And I remember he smoked a pipe.
Yep.
And do you remember this, too, when he'd get aspired? Sometimes he'd blow, and the sparks would come out of that pipe.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember he was very brilliant.
Yeah. No, I've met some really, good, sharp people over the years. You know, it's hard to think back, just name them off.
Well, let me name a couple more. Tom Tao.
Oh, yeah, he was, I thought, one of the, better informed legislators of all the issues that would come up all the time, and I had somebody else I was thinking about just before you mentioned Tom Tao. Francis Barno was always, you know, a really outstanding legislator. He did his homework and knew the issues, and he could get up and really, you know, explain himself even with his speech impediment, but he was one of the more effective legislators all the years that I was there. Well, Mike Malloy, too, he was, I think, one of the outstanding legislators.
Smart lawyer from Helena, who was majority leader his second session, I think.
Yeah.
Wasn't there very long.
No, attorney, I suppose he figured he could make more money.
Jim Donaldson beat him. I think he was only there two sessions.
Yeah, that's about all.
Yeah, he started out, he was a freshman. The second session there, he was a majority floor leader. And the third session, he was gone.
Yeah.
But I remember him, too, as a brilliant young fellow.
But that's kind of interesting. You know, I know as chairman of the House Education Committee, and we wanted like a 15% increase in the foundation program. And And, you know, he's in the leadership, and, oh, we only have money for 7%. And I know him and I got in a big debate in a late night session, and I finally did prevail. But they had problems with Tom Judge over that, too. But finally, we were able to get, you know, some decent increases in the foundation program, at least the schools could stay even with where they were at.
Now, Jack, you were in the legislature with Tom Judge.
Yeah.
And then you also were in the legislature when Tom Judge was governor. So you should have some pretty interesting impressions of him.
Oh, yeah. I remember when he was in the legislature, he had this cat house bill, they called it. And it was just simply that people go on vacation, they had to provide a house or something for their for their pets, you know, not just turn them outside and let them freeze to death. So that got labeled a cat house bill. And Tom went along with it good, but it seemed like he was one of the first sponsors of the Medicaid bill, Medicare and Medicaid. He did a good job. He was, I thought, an effective legislator. Did Tom serve in the Senate, too? He moved over to the Senate, didn't he?
Yeah, he moved over to the Senate, and then he was lieutenant governor under Governor Anderson, and then he became governor in 1972. He beat Ed Smith, I think.
Yeah.
Is that? Yeah. No. He beat... Is that right? Yeah.
That was about
He beat Ed Smith in 1972.
No, Tom was, I thought, one of the better governors we ever had. He was somebody he could lead, but he'd also listen to you, too. I know I had a few run-ins with him. Well, come on down, we'll talk to him, see if we can't work out something. And I always did feel like, you know, I'd go talk to him, and always got treated fairly. You know, he never tried to bulldoze you or anything. I thought you were real easy to work with, and boy, we passed a lot of good legislation back in
the middle 1970s.
Yeah, I think there's probably more legislation passed, you know, in the 70s. Well, you got in on a lot of that.
Well, in fact, that's been called the second progressive era in Montana state politics.
Yeah.
I think basically that wasn't a very long era either. It was probably 73, 74, and 75, maybe 77.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, it seemed like we had a special session just damn near every summer or something. I can't remember what the issues were.
I want to ask you more about Tom Tao, but we didn't talk much about Governor Anderson as governor. And you were a legislator all the time he was governor, and you knew him when he was attorney general. Did you have a working relationship with him? Do you remember much about him? You've mentioned that he had a strong personality.
Well, I don't know. It seemed like, you know, I agreed with most of the things he was promoting, and you know, then the different stuff I was involved with, it seemed like he would go along with it. You know, I never had any problems with him whatsoever, and I thought he was a strong governor, though, too. You know, he got that executive reorganization through, which we talked about that earlier. And then I remember the fights over the budget at that time, too.
Yeah.
We'd end up in...
Did you ever meet with him in his office? Ever have a one-on-one conversation with him that you can recall in his office or any place else?
Well, I used to, you know, even after he's governor, you know, he'd go out of his way, you know, he'd come over and talk to you. And
sure.
I just got along good with him, although I never had that many direct dealings with him.
Yeah.
In fact, I run into him in Hawaii a couple different times.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, he had and then he had a place down in Lake Havasu, too.
Yeah.
That I'd run into him once in a while there, and we always sit down and visit. And
because you went south in the winter? Did you go to Arizona in the winter?
Well, I used to go down like for a month or so. I had a motor home. But
I see.
I never was interested in going down there buying a house.
But you connected with him when you were down in Arizona in that month in the winter. And then just happened to run into him in Hawaii.
Yeah.
I'll be darned.
Yeah. And, in Arizona there, too, I just happened to run into him. He had a townhouse down there in a complex, and we sat down. And, you know, he wanted to know what's going on. I had to fill him in a little bit.
Sure.
I knew him with politics, and he always had an interest in that.
Now, Tom Tao... and we've talked about Miles Romney's vision of the need to impose a higher tax on coal.
Mm-hmm.
And we talked a little bit about representing Tom Tao. You mentioned you worked with him on single-member legislative districts. But from my recollection, Tao was really significant in terms of establishing the coal tax in Montana.
Oh, he was.
What do you remember about that whole coal tax debate?
Well, you know, I can't remember that we had that much controversy over it. You know, what had come in at 30%?
Yeah.
You know, and all.
Well, I don't think it existed until we imposed it at 30%. And yeah. I think it was Tao's bill. Is
yeah.
that right?
Well, and then I don't know if Tao had, you know, the environmental bills to make them, you know, redo the, you know, the spoil piles reclamation.
Yeah.
And he was really a big push on that, and he was darn well versed on it, and he was, you know, one of the guys that, one of Tom's problem was he could talk his everything to death.
Yeah.
You know, which is not a nice thing to say about him, but because he knew what he's talking about, but he just kept. I used to tell him, you know, come on, you made your point. I'll sit down. He sat right in front of me a couple sessions.
Oh yeah, he spoke. He was, as you mentioned, he was well informed, did his homework, but unfortunately, he did his homework on many things, and he commented on many things until most of us got damn tired of listening to him.
Yeah, that's about right.
Now, in terms of the coal tax. Obviously, the coal tax was opposed by, well, Montana Power Company would be a good example.
Oh, sure, sure.
Do you remember John Lahr?
Sure.
What do you remember about him? John Lahr was a lobbyist for Montana Power Company.
Well, I first got to know him when he was lobbying for the railroads. He was, his heart was really on the railroads. I think he lobbied for the NP and the BM, and I don't know, then he finally did go to work for the power company, but John was one, you know, I sat down and visited with him over a lot of legislation. Usually I was opposed to him, but, you know, he'd sit down and he'd say, well, I just want to tell you our side of it. And I'd go, okay, I don't agree with it, you know.
Yeah.
And he'd never hold a grudge or
anything. But he was the Montana Power Company lobbyist for Democrats.
Yeah.
And the Montana Power Company also had a lobbyist for Republicans.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
They played both sides.
Yeah.
But
Did you think of John Lahr as a Democrat?
Oh, not particularly. I just knew he was a lobbyist for the power company, whether Democrat
yeah.
or Republican. I think I knew the Republican lobby.
But I think he even attended Democratic, wasn't he a delegate to a Democratic National Convention or two?
Oh, he probably was.
Yeah.
He's always at state conventions.
Yeah.
And they still have, you know, a Democrat, you know, like...
Mike Pichette.
Yeah, Mike Pichette, you know. He.
Now, the Anaconda Company also had Democrat and Republican lobbyists. And there was a fellow by the name of Denny Shea.
Yeah.
You remember Denny Shea?
Yeah. Yeah, I never had much to do with him, because I think they knew my position pretty well, you know, even as a freshman, you know, from
yeah.
the background of my dad and my brother. And,
yeah.
And the people I associated with, they just didn't waste much time with me because they didn't think they'd ever get me to change my vote anyway. And,
so, Jack, were there other legislators that you considered yourself especially close to?
Well, we had a real close delegation, you know, in Cascade County in 65 when I first got elected, like Pete Gillian and Pat Gilfeather and John Hall and, you know, and then after Pete died, then his son, was that Pete Jr.?
But, yeah, I think so.
But we had, you know, we always had a good Democratic delegation that we would get together and, you know, like I say, that's how I ended up on the Education Committee, because, you know, with nine people, well, we'd like to have one on each of the, particularly the main committees. And then we'd meet, you know, to discuss different bills, so we, you know, hopefully thought we had a little more clout than everybody going a different
yeah.
direction.
So you mentioned Arnold Olson.
Yeah. Yeah, he, my dad knew him, you know, better than I did. I know my dad when he first ran for Attorney General. You know, as a
kid. Your dad was a legislator when Arnold Olson first ran for Attorney General.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know I had to go out and put up a bunch of big signs for him. You know, I was just a kid. And
sure.
I didn't know Arnold at that time.
Did you ever know Senator Mansfield?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Did you ever have a chance to visit with him personally?
Oh, yeah, like, you know, I used to go back to Washington, D.C., maybe three or four times a year, even when I was involved in all the stuff I was involved with through the Farmers Union, grain growers, and vocational education, everything. And, you know, you get back there, we'd call upon you know, Senator Mansfield, and like you say, he don't matter what how busy he was, he'd always take time to come out and say hello to you. And so and he knew everybody in Montana, I think, by the first name. And asked, well, how's your dad doing? Well, you name him. And and he was, like another guy that always impressed me like that is Hubert Humphrey. You know, I met him.
Really?
Through Farmers Union or GTA, and met him once, and I know I was going up to Senate office building one day, and he stepped in. Hey, Jack, how's everything in Montana? And I hadn't seen a man for 4 years.
That is amazing, isn't it?
Oh, how those guys can do it.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it either, but there's got to be a technique of some kind.
Yeah.
Right? So you have a good recollection of Mansfield.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember working with him on any particular issues?
No, not really, but, you know, any time you had a something particular as far as what was going on in the Senate, boy, he was more than happy to hear from you. And most of the time, it seemed like, you know, the issues I was interested in, he was too.
Yeah. When I met him several times, and he had an expression, at least that he used with me, when I met with him at his office after he had finished being a U.S. Senator and after he finished being ambassador to Japan. And he was working for a company back in, his office was in Washington, D.C. I'm not sure where their headquarters was. It was called Goldman and Sachs.
Yeah.
And so I visited with him in his office there, I don't know, three or four times, I think. And he had a favorite expression that he would, when the conversation was over, he'd get up when he was in his 90s.
Yeah, tapper light.
Tapper light. You heard that too, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That was his trademark expression. That instead of saying goodbye to you, he'd say tapper light.
Yeah. Well, I know more than once we'd be back there and, he'd be in session and going to the cloakroom there, you know, and ask if Senator Mansfield isn't available and take a note out. You might wait 10, 15 minutes, but he'd always come out and say hello. What you doing in town?
How about Senator Metcalf?
I knew him pretty well too, but I never really had that much direct contact with him. I think I had more contact with Mansfield than I did Metcalf. But Metcalf was, you know, always more in the environmental issues, you know, which at that time I wasn't, you know, was supported it and stuff, but never
was involved in it as involved with it.
Yeah, directly.
Did you ever know General Leroy Anderson?
Oh, sure. He was a neighbor up there. I knew him when he was in the Senate, too. And yeah, I worked on his campaign when he ran for Congress. And
yeah,
I was always mad at him that he ran against Metcalf. Or who was it he ran against in the Senate?
Well, Metcalf and Murray, all three of them ran at the same time.
Yeah.
Why were you mad at him?
Well, I thought he was doing a damn good job in the House, and we had two good candidates.
I see, yeah.
You know, you know, like John Melcher, too, doggone it. You know, I was a good friend of him.
Served in the legislature with him.
Oh, yeah. You know, and helped him on his campaign, Congress and Senate. I wanted him, you know, really work to get him reelected, but I wanted to get on this National Crop Insurance Board.
Yeah.
I think I would have had it if he hadn't got beaten. I told him he was in trouble in Montana.
Yeah.
You know, like particularly up with the...
Why do you think he was in trouble?
Well, they come out, you know, where he was supporting the Philippines and, and he wasn't paying that much attention to people in Montana. He wasn't around. And Byrne just come out, you know, and really worked it. The sawmills were going down and everything else. And I think if Melcher had come out and instead of running around the Philippines and stuff.
Now, what did he do? He took a trip to the Philippines while he was a U.S. Senator?
Yeah, I think he was gone until about 2 or 3 weeks before the election. You know, he come home, thought he didn't think he had any trouble. And Byrne, you know, really was beating the boondocks. And I think it just really caught him off.
Caught him off guard.
Off guard.
That was a big upset. I remember that too.
I was
amazed that that happened. I didn't see any polls or anything. And I was probably as surprised as Melcher was. I didn't expect Melcher was going to lose.
Yeah, I didn't either.
Now, we got just a few minutes left on the tape, Jack, and I want to go back and explore just briefly again this business of the Anaconda Company and the Montana Power Company and that sort of thing. If there's anything in our conversation that we've left out about that or anything you want to add?
Well, not back from my legislative years, you know, like I was almost diabolically opposed to everything that they had, and they knew it, so I didn't get lobbied all that much on it. But, you know, thinking about now on this 97 and that electric deregulation, that was the biggest fiasco. I did everything I could to try and defeat that. But
in 1997, the legislature passed legislation that has been characterized as decontrolling electrical power. And I think to some extent it did that. I'm not sure exactly completely what it did. And your feeling is that that was a big mistake.
Well, we had the cheapest electricity in the United States. Deregulators trying to get any cheaper. You know, it didn't make sense to me any way, shape, or form.
Yeah.
And it's just too bad, because then, you know, they just sold the state out. And, well, I don't know, you know, that's another environmental, or not, Enron deal.
Yeah.
You know, like who was the president who walked out of here with millions, and
yeah,
all these people that had stock in it, including me, I lost about $3,700 on it.
Yeah.
In stock.
Yeah. Well, I think most people agree that was a mistake.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
the
way it turned out.
And,
you know, like I say, well, I don't know, you know, like Ash Grove out here, they were a big, thought they could, you know, because they could buy a big block of power and maybe buy it directly from Bonneville or something like that. But, boy, as soon as that passed, hey, would they even have diesel locomotives out there trying to generate their own electricity? Because
yeah,
it went so damn sky high.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
Well, the mines in Butte closed down for 3 years because of that. I think those 350 jobs that they lost right there.
Oh yeah, yeah, that was a real torpedo with the water line of Montana's economy. There's no question about that.
Just no, but you know, with the railroads, you know, like UP and the ACM, you know, smelter going now closing up. You know, that had a lot to do too with the politics in Montana, or you know, where you had a lot of good working labor guys there, and all at once their jobs are gone.
Yeah,
I think that's changed the political climate.
Oh, no question about
it. Now we just have mainly service jobs. And
yeah,
the future doesn't look that bright to me right now.
Yeah, Jack, you have been a loyal Democrat all your life, and I think, do you regard yourself as a liberal Democrat?
Very liberal.
Then what advice would you give to your party as you look into the future that you feel would help them succeed in terms of Democrat and liberal principles?
Well, you have your principles and you got to stand up for them. You can't compromise them all the time.
So what principles should Democrats stand up for that they shouldn't compromise?
Well, like labor, well, even taxation now. You know, like these two bills of Elliott's that they just killed the other day to, you know, try and give the homeowners some tax relief. And why, those both got killed yesterday, I don't understand. But, you know, if you believe in fair taxation, fair wages.
And what does fair taxation mean to you?
That everybody pay a fair share, you know. And, you know, I'd almost go for tax with no exemptions. You know, that's where the tax system gets screwed up so fast. You pass a tax bill and, well, you exempt me from it. And everything gets exempted pretty quick. The only one left paying was Bob Brown, Jack Anderson.
Well, that doesn't sound like a good idea, does it?
Yeah.
Anything else, environmental issues or social issues that you'd advise Democrats to do?
Well, I think we got to keep, you know, environmental issues are an ongoing thing all the time, you know, with global warming, you know, you got to think these things through, not just today, tomorrow, but where we're going to be at 50 years from now. And like I say, this taxation thing, we've got to get this national thing straightened out. My great-grandkids aren't going to be able to pay off this deficit.
Yeah.
Health insurance, you know, like I'm that age now where I'm having lots of needs.
Yeah.
If I didn't have insurance, boy, it'd be, I'd go for a national health insurance program right now.
Okay. And of course, that's something Democrats have generally been supportive of, that Republicans have generally been opposed to. Yeah. But the national debt thing is kind of the opposite of that. I mean, generally, the Republican Party has been the party that's been opposed to deficit spending and the national debt, and the Democrats have thought, well, in order to accomplish good purposes, maybe you have to spend a little money sometimes. Yeah. Now the opposite seems to be the case.
Yeah, like Conrad Burns, you know, boy, we're going to have a locked box on Social Security. We can't. They're going to lock that money up and the last few years, oh, that don't mean anything. Well,
yeah.
But this, you know, like with reforming Social Security, I just cannot understand Bush. You know, especially like the last week, the stock market's dropped 800-900 points.
Yeah. Yeah. His idea is that Social Security may be in trouble because at this point in time in the year 2005, we have fewer people paying into Social Security all the time because of the way the birth rate is, and we have more people living longer taking money out of Social Security than has been the case up until now. So his idea is that instead of paying for Social Security in the conventional way, we allow people somehow or other to invest in private accounts, and the idea would be that the stock market and the natural expansion of the economy grow faster than the way the Social Security money is managed now. So since we don't want to cut benefits, and since we can't keep people from living so long, and since we can't force people to have more babies, that his idea is we make the money work harder. And that's a good argument as long as the stock market's expanding. But when we're going through a time like we are right now, where the stock market is dropping like a rock, then people think, well, that's a good way to lose money.
Well, like right now, take out a 401k, isn't it the same thing as what he wants to set up?
Yeah.
You know how you end up with
they're not the most.
But as far as, you know, not having the workers go in there, or having many workers to support it, but look what's happened to salary.
Yeah.
Why that 90,000? You and I pay 100% on it, but anybody over $90,000, I'd take the cap clear off and you'd fund that goddamn thing forever.
Yeah.
You know, and salaries are going up, so why shouldn't they pay?
Yeah.
More percentage.
And the cap seems to be just arbitrarily there. I mean, it could be at any number that you wanted.
I don't know why they ever put that on there. I guess I think that was a deal to gain votes.
Yeah,
you know,
probably was. Well, that could be easily adjusted, I think.
Sure.
Just a few seconds left. Anything to say in closing?
That's about all I can think of. I wish I had more help to you,
well,
but I tell you, my legislative experience is something you'd never forget, and you meet some wonderful people, and you, it's equivalent to college education, which I didn't have.
Well, you were a good legislator, and I remember that well, and it was my great pleasure to serve with you, and you have contributed to Montana history, and I appreciate your making available this part of our Montana State Archives, Jack.
Well, that's one thing I could always say about you when I was in the legislature. You were one person you could always talk to, even on the Republican side.
Well, I appreciate
Not that it. We always voted the same, but we could talk it over.
That's true, and I value your friendship. Thank you, Jack.
You betcha.